Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Matt Sapinski, and he'll be answering your most important questions on selectivity. The show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're going to be broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Matt a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and your email address in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within about 48 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Matt Sapinski about selectivity. Front Range Anglers, a full-service fly shop located in Boulder, Colorado, provides premium tackle and comprehensive instruction and guide services to fly fishers across the country. In business for over 31 years and with a staff that averages 20 years of experience, they will give you the straight story on gear, places to fish, flies, and techniques. They publish a monthly newsletter that is one of the most informative and insightful electronic magazines in the industry. Find out more about this premier shop by logging onto their website at frontrangeanglers.com. That's frontrangeanglers.com. Before we introduce Matt, I'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. If you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and look for the link under Matt's section that says click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Matt's latest book, Selectivity, courtesy of Stackpole and Headwaters Books. Here's how you can win. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show, and the question will be something that Matt and I talk about during the show. You must submit your answer along with your name and your location in the text on our box on our homepage, and the first person that gets that in correctly will win Matt's book. So listen closely. Sharpen up your typing skills and be ready, because it's going to be an incredible book that you'll want to have. So pay attention, and maybe you'll win Matt's book. Tonight our guest is Matt Sapinski. Matt is a fly fishing guide, outfitter, instructor, lodge owner, operator, freelance writer and photographer, book author, and culinary trained chef in Michigan. He has been fly fishing since the age of 7 and for 46 years thereafter, having been brought up in the Niagara frontier of upstate New York and spending time as a boy in Poland. Prior to being a full-time fly fishing guide, he was in the international corporate hotel business, working in Europe and the U.S. for several hotel chains, including Sheraton, Omni, Renaissance, and Westin Hotels, in the food and beverage management. In 1995, he opened Gray Drake and Troughton Eagle Lodges. That's at www.graydrake.com. which he and his wife, Lori, have been operating for over 18 years. He guides clients for trout, steelhead, and salmon 280 days a year on Michigan's Great Lakes rivers like Muskegon, Pierre Marquette, Big Manistee, and St. Joseph. Matt's book authorships have been bestsellers and have spanned 16 years. They include River Journal, Pierre Marquette from Amato's, Steelhead Dreams and Steelhead Dreams 10-Year Anniversary Editions, and Orvis Guide to Great Lakes Salmon and Steelhead. His latest books include Steelhead Dreams 12-Year Anniversary and the current bestseller on Amazon, eBay, and Barnes & Noble, Selectivity. Matt has appeared on national TV and is in the was the Midwest Regional Editor, Salmon Steelhead Column Editor in Fly Fish America, the Salmon Steelhead Salmon Column Editor in Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, and Regional Editor, Midwest Fly Fisherman Magazine. Well, Matt, and I only read about half your bio there, so welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
That's cool. I'm going to bed. Jeez, I'm bored.
Yeah, well, well, you've
that,
been
that introduction put me to sleep.
Well, you've been through all that already. See, it's all old news for you, but
I'm just kidding.
Yeah. Yeah, you've got a lot under your belt. You go from cooking fish to catching fish, right? Sounds like.
That's the cooking part is as passionate as fly fishing is for me. But I'm a catch and release 100%. I think I let my first fish go when I was 16 years old, and I've come to Jesus since then, and I've never killed a fish. I know it sounds crazy, but
yeah.
I'm in the tree hugger with fish. So, yeah, it's been a long journey, but it's all fun, and the passion of fly fishing and understanding selectivity and all this crazy stuff that I'm coming out with is where my mind needs to wander every day. If I don't have stimulation from a culinary standpoint or from a fishing standpoint, I don't have the, it doesn't.
It's not a full day, is it?
Exactly.
Yeah. I hear you. I love to cook too. It's one of my passions too, and enjoy it immensely. And I also like the second part of that, which is the eating part.
Oh yeah, there's no question about it. We have something in the Great Lakes called walleye, pike, and perch, which are delectables, and the steelhead and our salmon and our trout are for the mind and the soul and the rod and the fly. But walleye was God's gift to the table, I think.
Excellent fish, excellent. Well, listen, we've got a lot to cover. Your book is incredible in depth, and who thought somebody could write a whole book on selectivity, but you did, and took an approach, to be quite honest, I hadn't looked at it that way at all, and so I've got a lot to learn here tonight as well. So let's just talk about, first off, you know, how you see selectivity. You know, is it real? Is it always present? You know, what's your overall thoughts on this? Because we often talk about that, and we say, oh, they're picky today. Are they always picky? You know, is this an overall writing theme we should be paying attention to? How do you see it?
Well, that's a good question. You know, my mentor, one of my mentors is Kyle Richards. When I moved to Michigan, he was a dentist in Rockford, and he wrote an epic book in the 70s, the golden era of fly fishing in the 70s, called Selective Trout. And that was one of the first books that, as a little boy growing up in the Niagara Frontier, I was bagging groceries one day in a store, and a guy drove up in a truck waiting for his wife to get out of the grocery market, and I saw this book on his dashboard. It said Selective Trout, and he had a Trout Unlimited sticker on the back of his car, and I was bagging groceries and putting it in the car. I said, oh, my God, where'd you get that book? That book looks amazing. He said, this is the latest, greatest stuff about trout fishing, and it was Carl Richards, Swisher Richards, Selective Trout. And I had a paper route, and I had made a little money here and there being an altar boy and stuff. But when the library came and got the book, I took the book out, and I never checked it back in. And my mother was furious that I didn't return the book. So she made me took me down by the ear and took me down to the library and made me return the book 2 months later, and I had to do, like, community service because I stole the book. But I was enamored with the concept of selective fish, and we always use the word selective. All the fish are selective today. Well, what does that really mean? Well, they're picky, they're fussy, they're blah, 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 blah. I tend to believe that fish are constantly in a selective state based on two things, based on their life survival strategy and based on their predator foraging profiles. And these are PFP and LSS. You're going to be hearing a little more about them in the future, because everything's driven by evolutionary process. Everything's driven by what nature dictates in these fish. But they're not always stupid. They're not always aggressive. They're not always passive. They're not indolent. They're in a constant state of discerning based on what their evolutionary process has dictated them to do. So it's always present. Yes. Is it real? Absolutely. If you want to fish a royal coachman on your little stream with stock trout and be a hero, God bless you. But today's world is catch and release, intricate patterns, fishing emergers, fishing stillborns. You go to Henry's Fork, you go to the Delaware, you go to the Latour, you go anywhere, you're going to get your butt smoked. You're going to understand selectivity. End of subject.
Good. Good. Okay. Now, in your book, you start out by, and by the way, we're kind of working through a little of the format of the book. There's, of course, way more in the book than we can cover tonight. But Matt talks to trout, to steelhead, and to salmon. So we're going to kind of break out our show tonight in those three areas and try to deal with each one. But writing overall, he's broken it out into selectivity phases. So, Matt, can you, and this rides over all three types of fish, so can you kind of explain your phased approach and break that out for us?
Yeah, exactly. There's three phases, the aggressive active phase, the selective reflective phase, and the passive dormant phase. So they're self-explanatory, but the aggressive active is the primordial kill artist hunter. He's more active, that he's in constant hunt for food. He's looking at food. He's in a complete hunger state. The selective reflective mode is extremely fussy and discerning, calculating, looking at food types, not really sure, the game of nods, as one of my mentors, Vince Marinaro, said, constantly looking, maybe not sure. You see that on spring creeks a lot. You see that in lakes where fish are cruising shallows and backwater sloughs. And then you have a passive dormant phase where their biological life survival strategy tells them that they should shut down. And it's based on water temperatures. It's based on floods. It's based on cloudy water conditions, turbidity. It's based on spawning survival. They all come under that life survival strategy of how these species survived. Brown trout 70 million years ago, 35 million years ago, brook trout, 55 million years old, Atlantic salmon. These things had to have a constant barometer, a constant watch, a mechanism to constantly dictate them when they should exert use caloric output instead of caloric intake and blah, 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 this constant balance that's going on. And that's how selectivity is a constant process. So today, hopefully someday, people are going to say, well, the fish were selected today, because that really annoys me, because there's three phases of that selectivity. If you understand them, you're going to do extremely well and apply it to your everyday fishing.
Is this individual fish specific, or does it tend to affect, the fish as a whole in a section of river? In other words, if we've got 100 fish in the next 100 yards, are they all going to be acting the same, or do they all have their own phase that they're in?
That's a really good question, because, as much as, people give me crap about, saying, oh, you're trying to put too many human personalities into fish, the more time you spend on the water, you'll find out that certain fish are more photophobic, certain fish are more anti-noise, certain fish are more anti-noise. Each fish, I believe, has personalities based on their habitat, based on the type of foods they were feeding upon. So, yes, there's certain fish that will spend more time in the aggressive active phase. They're more dominant in their genetics. They're more alpha aggressive. There's certain shyer fish. As human beings, there's shy people, there's aggressive people, there's alpha people, there's submissive people. There's certain fish that they're just petrified out of eating. They won't even eat because they're so afraid. And then there's ones that are completely passive dormant that, need somebody just needs like a little bit of vegetables for the day and they're good. So I know it sounds, there's a word starts with an A, and actually I speak Polish better than I speak English, but there are individual fish personalities that you could say, oh, I know this brown underneath that bush over there. I know where he's going to take, and I know what he's going to take, and I know when he's going to come out. Those are based on their life survival strategies, but based on the amount of dominant genetics that they have in their genetic system. That is so crucial to the way they behave. So, yes, there are individual personalities and individual phases.
So you could have a big brown trout that's just pretty much pissed off most of the time, and is something comes by, he's going to attack it just because
exactly.
He's pissed off in general.
All the time. 24-7 wants to eat a streamer as long as your leg, and then you have a 26-inch brown trout that sips midges all day.
Yeah. Interesting. That makes it even harder for us. Not easier.
Oh, yeah. It's brutal. It's absolutely brutal. And the more you get involved, if you fish tailwaters and spring creeks, you'll know it more. But, you know, even freestone fish can be extremely phased into the selective reflective phase because their eyesight is so much stronger. In the book, I talk about Catoctin Mountains, the big hunting creek in Catoctin Mountains. And those brown trout were almost impossible to catch. And everybody says, well, a freestone fish, just put on the Royal Coachman or a Royal Trout or a Prince Nymph and you'll damn catch them because the water's turbid. They're opportunistic. They have to grab the food. Winter's coming. Absolutely not. Their vision sometimes is more impeccable than in a low, lazy stream where Frank Sawyer once said that brown trout get cataracts and lazy eyes because they have too much time to look at their food and they actually become more stupid. So there's a lot of dichotomous information coming from depending on who you talk to.
Interesting. Now, Thomas Murphy from Redmond, Washington wrote in and he said, define selective versus just a bad day. You know, and I think what he's getting at is, are you as a fisherman just having a bad day or are the fish being ultra selective on that day?
Is that for Thomas or me?
For you, yeah. Thomas is asking it. Define selective versus
just a bad day. That's a tough one because just if I'm on a river, I'm having a good day. But just a bit selective, just a bad day is that there's something going on in the process of the fish that day where you thought you had the hatch figured out, you thought you had the right size, you probably tied the right emerger, you have the spent spinner just the right way, and you're not getting this fish to cooperate. So something in the schema of that selective reflective phase is not going your way. And this happens a lot on big tailwaters and spring creeks where one day they're finally tuned into like gluing olives or sulfurs, and then in one day they switch over their mechanism to taking size 28 cream midges, and you're having a bad day. Presentation is very important. Size, extremely important. Type of insects, very important. I'm reading this thing here, fishing selective. Do you feel in matching hatch works? Yeah, absolutely. You know, there's a book, there's several books. There's two huge dichotomous schools here. There's a school that there's, and the reviews that I've gotten in my book have been epic. I'm over the moon. 95% of them have been, this is incredible stuff. This is really groundbreaking. And 5% of people saying this is absolutely idiotic. Trout are stupid. They're pea brain. They're idiot. Put a goddamn Adams on. Excuse my French. Just put an Adams on. Get the right size. Size 14. Put it out there. They're stupid. They're pea brain. They take anything. God bless those guys. I mean, if that's their gig, God bless them. But you put them on selective waters, and they're going to have a whole come-to-Jesus look at things, okay? So matching the hatch, yeah, it worked. That's what selective trout did in 1974. And in 1974, Switcher and Richards said that, I hope, as more people get into catch-and-release waters, which back in the Marinero days, 30s, 40s, there wasn't a lot of catch-and-release waters. These fish, they could only actually fish in Pennsylvania until, like, June. Then the season was closed. So they had very little high-tech patterns, high-tech materials. People didn't know what emergers were or spend spinners or crippled. Things have evolved such an eclectic, cerebral level in fly fishing that the trout, salmon, and steelhead are evolving right along with it and probably going five steps above it because they're staying abreast of trying not to get caught. So, yeah, all these things matter. But presentation size and type does matter, but I talk about color. Other people say color is baloney, so I don't know.
You talk about evolutionary process, and we talk about that on the stream. You know, we say, well, these fish are getting smarter. They're getting smarter. You know, it's harder to catch fish than it used to be here on this stream. Do you see that happening? I mean, is it happening that quickly, you know? I mean, over a period of the past, 30, 40 years when the streams have been getting hammered more and more?
Absolutely. I firmly believe it. And I'm a guy that works, you know, close to like 250 days a year. And I fish probably 300 days a year, 310 days a year. And then I try to keep my family glued together. But the bottom line, I think the selectivity is going at a much rapid rate at pace right now due to environmental factors, due to changing water conditions due to droughts, to floods, to incredible pressure from man, boats, drift boats, jet boats, catch and release waters, wading, perfect patterns, perfect materials. Before it was like you could put, you know, anything on and a hare's ear or a pheasant tail or a whatever and catch trout. Today, trout get caught over and over again, which is a wonderful resource. That's what it's all about. So the more you catch them, the more selective they get, the more reflective they get, then they could almost get into a passive dormant state where, like on some parts of catch and release waters, fish are afraid to even eat natural foods because they might be caught. So it's going to make for a tough day, whether you look at it. So you better be up on your game plan. You better have the right tippets and the right flies and the right angle and blah, blah. So it goes on and on and on. It never stops.
Yeah. Well, we need to, Matt, take a quick break here. But hang tight. We'll be right back, and we'll talk more about selectivity. Women's Fly Fishing in Alaska is owned and operated by well-known female guide Pudge Kleinkopf. Women's Fly Fishing offers several lodge-based fly fishing schools for women, as well as an array of small group-guided trips for women and couples to some of Alaska's best-known waters for salmon, rainbow trout, Arctic grayling, and char. Pudge also leads saltwater fly fishing groups to Mexico each spring. Beginners are welcome, and equipment is provided. Learn more about fly fishing for women at www.womensflyfishing.net. That's www.womensflyfishing.net. Or call Pudge directly at 907-274-7113. That's 907-274-7113. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Matt Sapinski about selectivity. If you'd like to ask Matt a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, Matt, I always ask my guests at this point in the show, you know, what's going on in your fly fishing world? So tell us a little bit about what you guys do up there in Michigan, and fill us in.
Well, you know, this is a real unique ecosystem over here, Roger. We have just about everything, and I think the reason why I set up shop here in Michigan, I was looking at all over the country since I wanted to get out of the hotel business because I was totally burned out, and you can only work so many 18-hour days for 7 days a week, and now I'm probably actually working more as a guide and writer and author, but Michigan is a huge ecosystem. I think we have more fresh, cold water than any place in the world, with four Great Lakes and tens of thousands of miles of Blue Ribbon trout streams. This area, I mean, like today in our river on the Muskegon River, we have fresh chrome steelhead coming in, dropback steelhead. We have big browns and rainbows taking stoneflies, and then soon to be great rake hatches and isonychia hatches and blueing olive hatches and hexagenia hatches. And then we have little tiny creeks that you could jump across right in our backyard full of brook trout. And then famous rivers like Pere Marquette, Manistee. We have coho salmon right now eating bait fish in the surf, and up north we have Atlantic salmon chasing smelt in the surf, and so I really don't know anywhere on a consistent basis where you get giant steelhead, giant lakewood browns, giant resident browns, giant rainbows, big brookies, Atlantic salmon, Pacific salmon, lake trout, all in like one little 100-mile circle. So we're kind of gifted up here, and we're kind of spoiled because we could go from 0X to 7X, we go from size 4-0 to size 28 in one day. So that sums up what we're doing.
Okay. Now, do you have a lodge up there and guide service?
Yes, we have the Great Drake Lodge, yes, and right on the river, and we get people from all over the world, and we've got some great clients over the years, and it's just a wonderful thing because everybody comes here to learn all the different types of fishing that we have, and with selectivity, I could tell them about the different things that are happening and not have to have a bad day on the river and understand why you're having a bad day, and let's make our adjustments correctly to do that.
Right. And what's the website people would go to find out about your guide service and lodge?
They would go to www.graydrake.com, graydrake.com.
Okay, great.
And that has all our offerings, and it's based on the Great Drake Cyphalinoris hatch. We have one of the best mayfly hatches that last about 8 weeks, and the mayfly is about size 12, Cyphalinoris, cover the water, and when we first built the lodge, the entire lodge was coated the next morning with a bazillion spinners, and that's why the lodge turned gray, so we call it Gray Drake. So
kind of a blessing, huh, of the lodge?
It was a blessing, yeah, to have mayflies cover your lodge, you know, so yeah.
That's funny. Okay, good. Well, let's jump back into selectivity here, and let's start talking about trout more specifically. So maybe you could address, you know, your three phases, talking more specifically about trout, because I'm sure as we go through the night, you're going to explain to us how, you know, the different fish are maybe different in these different phases, I suppose. Is that true?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, I mean, in trout selectivity, you got three phases, aggressive, active, selective, reflective, and passive dormant. But what's interesting is that, you know, when they're in an aggressive, active phase trout, you'll have a heavy hatch, okay? Let's say the first hatch of the year, a Hendrickson hatch or a Mother's Day caddis hatch or something like that. There'll be very strong, resolute feeding to that hatch during that time frame when it's happening. But like in the Hendricksons, they might only be targeting the cripples and the emergers versus the adults. So, or the same in the sulfur hatch, same in the PMD hatch that you have in the western stream. So it's a frenzied feeding, but a very efficient feeding, and it's very discriminating to a certain phase. So you might have, you know, I spent days on Nelson Spring Creek where the PMDs were out there, and I'm fishing a dry fly, and everybody's fishing a sunken pheasant tail nymph in the film with some CDC, and they're crushing them. And this is the difference in trout selectivity, is that in the aggressive active phase, you have selectivity in that phase to a certain way a bait fish, you know, drunk and disorderly streamer by Tommy Lynch swims, or something like that, or a streamer by Kelly Gallup, or, you know, they're going to be selective to a specific stimuli that they see. So trout selectivity is probably the most fussy, quirky out of all the phases. And then once they're in the selective reflective phase, or SR phase, they're extremely compound and leisurely in their feeding. They're looking at everything. They're almost like overfed slobs that just don't want, you know, nothing else. They're just like they've had it all. They've seen it all. You're going to have to do something really good for me to get me out of this phase. That fly better be incredible. This is usually a result of very abundant and diverse food sources and a preoccupation with minutia. Usually minutia, small blueing olives, tiny midges, the preoccupation with minutia will fine-tune the details of the fly. Right now on my computer screen, I'm sitting on the deck listening to the crickets, and I'm seeing midges come all over my laptop, and I'm getting selective reflective midges. Just kidding. But this is what gets them into that phase when they have so many different abundant food sources that they have the affordance to be selective reflective. And then passive dormant, overfeeding, satiation, the big mayfly hatch, salmon fly hatch out west, hexagenia hatch here, green drake hatch here. They had enough change in weather, spawning, excessive pressure will push them in the passive dormant phase. But usually satiation is the biggest one. And when you hit a big mayfly hatch or a big stonefly hatch, you want to be there at least, you know, 48 hours into it or 48 hours going out of the phase, because those are the two phases the fish are most vulnerable to.
Okay. Well, we have some specific questions relating to trout. So let's hit some of these that our audience has sent in. Bob in Morris, Illinois, wrote in. He says, when you find fish generally holding hard, indifferent, or lethargic for whatever reasons, do you find it more productive to make just a few well-placed casts with your best guess fly and return later, or try enticing them with repeated presentations to the point of provoking a strike? So it sounds like these kind of fish may be in the selective reflective phase here. Is that what it sounds like?
You do. You have fish in the selective, reflective, or passive dormant phase. But, Bob, that's a very, very intelligent question, because 90% of the time we flog the water. We get the best equipment. You start beating the water to the froth. We're good casters. And we try to force feed these fish when they will not feed. And it's better to sit down, smoke a cigar, whatever you want to do, look at the water, rest the fish. The more you take the fly away from the fish, the more you enhance chance for that fish to take your fly. So a few well-placed casts, as I'm seeing, with your best guess fly and return later, or try and touch them with repeated presentations to the point of provoking a strike. Provoking a strike only leads to failure. It only shuts down a fish from the selective reflective phase to a passive dormant phase. So don't provoke it. let the fish make the mistake of coming to you, always entice, always in Atlantic salmon. I learned a lot from Atlantic salmon fishing when I first caught my first one on the Baltic Ocean tributaries in Poland, is that you always rest your fish. And all the guys that fish Atlantic salmon that go out with good Atlantic salmon guides, always, you know, if a fish comes for your dry fly and refuses it or noses it, you stop right there. Don't go any further and give it a little break. Let the fish think about what it could have had. And it's almost like an enticing little game you're playing. It's almost romancing the fish.
Interesting. Yeah. Teasing it a bit, making it think about
exactly.
It a bit. Yeah. Okay, we got
that. They don't think about it. They think about opportunistic. They're totally kill artists. These are kill artists. They specialize in killing to live. But if you show them, like when you throw a streamer and you're stripping it really hard and you have two or three follows, let the fish go back to its fly, let it think about what it could have had, and then usually that, you know, 10 minutes later, that fish is going to come and just crack it because it's like it's what they need to survive. Yep.
Yeah. Okay, we've got Scott Nelson in Portland, Oregon, and he wrote in and asked, will impressionistic or suggestive fly patterns work with selective fish when the characteristics of size, shape, color, and animation are met? That's as an example, a soft tackled wetter, La Fontaine, sparkle pupa, for the pupa or emergent stage of caddis.
That's an excellent question, and that's exactly a perfect answer to the question. Yes, impressionistic suggestive patterns work very well with, you know, I fish a lot of soft tackles. A lot of people fish soft tackles, sparkle pupa. Exact imitations are not always the perfect answer as much as we think. So, you know, there's all these flies out there, Gison Sweden, all these, you know, these perfection flies, everything looks just perfect, but it's the old beat-up pattern that's shredded to death, the hackles all over the place, the tubbies all over the place. There's a certain charm in soft hackle patterns, sparkle pupa. Why does sparkle pupa work so well? Why do things like that work so well? You know, there's a doctor on BC. I was very fortunate to be the guest speaker at the Fly Fishers Club of Harrisburg this year in Pennsylvania in March. The club, second oldest fly fishing club in the country, where Marinero, Fox, you know, Schwiebert, Wolf were at, and founded the club. And there was a doctor talking about UV polarization and UV light and polarization and how it affects the fly and how the fly looks to the fish and how the V-wing of the prince nymph is. As most of us, you know, a selective guys think, oh, prince nymph is just for idiots and zug bugs for idiots. But the V-shape of that silhouette casts something very special to the trout. And this guy gave a whole almost doctoral thesis at the luncheon at the Allenberry on UV light and how it reflects against patterns and the silhouette of the fly. So a lot of the time, just simple soft tackle patterns or the new UV materials will make a tremendous difference in the way a fish sees a fly, even though it's not the exact imitation, but there's something going on there, which I call motion without movement, MNWM, which I talked about in Steel of Dreams. Soft tackles are perfect for it. A lot of this, you know, new Antron sparkle pupa, all this UV stuff. So, yeah, you don't always have to imitate it exactly. I think a lot of times fish that are selective reflective see so many exact imitations that they look for the odd and weird and freaky. You know, it's kind of weird.
Dennis in the Ozarks of Missouri says, I fish in southwest Missouri and Arkansas streams and rivers that are usually clear and shallow. I always see the big bows and browns cruising slowly along the shores. No matter what you try to put near them, they just keep on cruising. What is the tactic I should be using to get them interested? I've heard of fly fishermen scoping or spot casting just for these big guys, but have never been successful at it myself.
So southwest Missouri, Arkansas, you got a lot of scuds, you got a lot of south bogs, you got a lot of midges, okay? So these critters, and you got a good amount of stocked fish. You got a pretty heavily stocked fishery there. There is natural reproduction in some of the Arkansas streams. There's some natural reproduction in the Missouri streams. So when you have these big cruisers, they're probably in the search for midge pupa. They're probably in the search for, I don't know, coming back to mama in the hatchery. It's kind of a funny thing to say. But what you probably need to do in that situation is, if they're cruising a lot and you're pursuing them, they're probably cruising from the fact that you're pursuing them too much. So, once again, I always say the best thing that could ever happen to an angler is to sit down, watch the fish, and watch them habituate to your surroundings. I talk a lot about habituation and selectivity, and it's really funny. The other day we were on the Muskegon guiding, and we parked my little power drifter self-craft, and it was amazing how huge steelhead and huge browns literally came within a rod's cast from my boat once they habituated to my presence of being non-threatening. And too many times we get in the water, we start flogging the water, we chase fish, we move upstream, guess what happens to the fish? He moves downstream. We move downstream, the fish moves upstream. And the fish are constantly on a cruising. Well, they're probably irritated by your presence. And if you have what I hear, the magic word here is usually clear and shallow, which means they see the four R's, reflection, refraction, your waiting ripple. And the other one's rain, but the rain is actually good for you because it clouds the surface. But low, shallow, clear water, absolutely. It's brutal on them, and they're going to constantly cruise.
Okay, we need to take another quick break here. We'll come back, and we've got several more questions from our audience about trout, so we'll dig into those. So just give me a half a minute here, and we'll be right back. Keeney's Fly Shop in Sacramento, California, features classes on all aspects of fly fishing. They have an extensive inventory and fly tying department and a friendly, experienced staff whose primary goal is your complete satisfaction. Among their many services, one can book private waters or take advantage of their international travel service. Visit their extensive website at www.keeney.com. That's K-I-E-N-E.com. Or call Keeney's Fly Shop at 1-800-400-0359. That's 1-800-400-0359. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Matt Sapinski about selectivity. If you'd like to ask Matt a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, another one up that was sent in by Dan in Redwood City, California. He says, many people swear by fluoro because they say it's less visible. I've looked at fluoro in a glass of water and compared it to nylon tippet. I think they are both easy to see, and a fish must see it even better. Is the fluoro advantage possibly due to something other than visibility to the fish's eye, micro drag maybe, or another reason?
Dan, fluorocarbon scientifically has proven that it's the same density as water, so fish don't see it. I would say that on most rivers, fluorocarbon in very clear situations does make a big difference, but probably 70% of the time it doesn't make a difference. And, you know, that's the verdict is the jury's not out on that one because I do really well with fluoro on extremely clear spring creeks and tailwaters, on more turbid waters, on more darker stained waters, on tannic waters, dystrophic waters. Fluoro doesn't really matter. Micro drag, actually, you'll get more drag out of fluoro. So, you know, you're going to have to be the guest on that one, Dan. You're going to have to say, hey, am I having more success with fluoro or mono? I think on clear situations, it's proven scientific fact that fluoro is better. Turbid waters, more dystrophic, tannic waters, it really doesn't matter.
Okay. Rob Otten. Oden in Ridgewood, New Jersey wrote in. He says, are larger trout more selective than smaller ones?
Yankees. What is that? Yankees. Oh, okay. Large trout more selective.
He's rooting for the Yankees. Yeah. That's all.
Oh, Yankees. Okay. Generally, yes, because they've been around longer. They've probably been hooked. But their vision starts to go as they get older. So they get a little more lazier. They get a little more confident in their food sources. my, you know, my idol, Frank Sawyer, says that the biggest brown trout on the River Avon in England became really lazy, stupid, and fat, and didn't care. And when they made a decision to eat something, they ate it. Whereas the little ones, the small ones, have keener eyesight, keener metabolisms. They can be, you know, you go to the big spring in Pennsylvania and try to catch a 6-inch brook trout, you're going to get your butt handed to you because they're extremely cognizant of everything that's going on out there. And I'm not a buyer on that. I've had brook trout in the Shenandoah kick my butt. I've had brook trout all over the place. I've had little tiny browns in the Latorte beat me to death. So size does not matter when it comes to selectivity because there's a lot going on with the learning process there. So that's my best answer to you. Oh, and Rob. That's my buddy Rob Otten from New Jersey. Yeah. God bless you. Hate the Yankees. No, I love the Yankees. Okay, so the one you missed up there from Ryan Mass in Snoqualmie.
Ryan asked about the go-to pattern in most NIP situations or new waters. So is there, do you have a searching pattern or?
You know, there's, you know, the, I go back to Frank Sawyer again, pheasant tail nymph. You can't beat a pheasant tail nymph. A zug bug, a pheasant tail nymph. Pheasant tail nymph pretty much does everything, and I know it's nothing new and exciting, and I got 10,000 nymph patterns in my books. I do a lot of wiggle nymphing lately. I do wiggle nymphs for blooming olives, for isonychias, for hex. I think that the swimming nymphs really do impart a lot of action, and a standard hook does not accomplish that. So I'm putting the wiggle articulated nymphing into just about everything I do now. It takes a little longer to tie, but you really can't go wrong with a basic, somewhat of a hare's ear. You know, Sawyer, again, had the gray goose, and he had the killer bug, which were all these variations. And if you look at their silhouette and profile, they were imitating nymphs. They were imitating Batisca nymphs, Betis nymphs. They were imitating crest bugs, crustacea. You're going to have silhouettes of underwater invertebrates that most fish will habituate to. And that's what these nymphs do. They're fancy. A prince nymph is still effective. You know, you stick with some of the basics, you're probably going to do very well, even with selective reflective fish.
We got DB and Escondido pretty much asked the same question Rob asked, so I think we covered that one. Okay, here's your buddy Rob again. He says, wants to know where the most selective trout are found in the United States.
Well, that's a good question, and there's probably a ton of places that I don't know about where they're found, but you could pretty much bet your booty that if you're going to fish the west branch of the Delaware or the main Delaware or the east branch of the Delaware or the Neversink and the Catskills, you're going to fish the Cumberland Valley, you're going to find the Latorte, Yellow Beaches, Falling Springs, Big Spring, State College, you're going to fish Spruce Creek, the Little Jay. You're going to come down through. There's some streams in Maryland, like the Gunpowder, to be selective. You could go then into the Wisconsin Driftless area and find some really fussy fish, Timber Coulee, Westport Kickapoo, Mossy Creek in Virginia could have selective fish. The Arkansas, you know, the Little Red, and they could be selective at times to crest bugs there. Then you branch out more off the West Coast, and then you got the Mysis shrimp gig on the Frying Pan and and all your incredible tailwaters in Colorado. You want to talk about selectivity. You know, Pat Dorsey and those guys are just dealing with it every day. And then you got, you know, out west, you got, you know, Hat Creek, Hot Creek in California. You got the Henry's Fork, which is a monster. And you want probably my number one most selective, reflective, insane beast to crack is Silver Creek in Idaho.
Now, I've heard that. I've never fished it, but, yeah. I heard that's one of the toughest places to fish as well.
That sums it up, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So just about everywhere they're selective.
On any given day, right? Time or another. Absolutely. Yeah. Okay, you're going to stop fishing New Jersey, Rob. Get selective when it comes to August, trust me.
Now, and I take it there is a difference between hatchery fish and wild fish.
You know, that's an interesting question. It depends where the genetic stock is coming from. So, once again, we in Michigan here have some interesting strains of fish. So we have our hatchery system is the most important thing to have a diversity in hatchery fish is to have a constant influx of feral, wild state of genetics coming into the hatchery fish. So if you have hatchery mutants, like some hatchery systems have, that strictly have these inbred, inbreeding in humans and fish do not have good results, okay? Let's just say that. It's not a good thing for everybody. Genetic diversity is always a very positive thing. It infuses intelligence, infuses selectivity, it infuses perception. Here we try to stock wild strains. So we have a Gilcrest brown trout strain that has been around for almost 130 years since we brought Michigan had the first brown trout stockings on the Pere Marquette in 1883. So we go to these little streams like the Sturgeon River and the Gilcrest Creek and pick up these strains of fish that have been around for 130 years and use them in our hatchery system. So in all essence, you're using a wild fish and just bringing them up in a prep school environment with three square meals of pellets a day, a warm environment at 45 to 55, and we do this with our steelhead. We harvest them from a feral, F-E-R-A-L, feral wild state of the Little Manistee River. So what we're getting out of the hatchery is, in all essence, a wild fish. But if you keep those broodstock in there forever and ever, they actually get so stupid they forget to swim. So if that makes any sense, it is. You know?
Yeah, yeah. You had mentioned Silver Creek before, and I just see down below here we got a question from Ross in Idaho Falls, Idaho, wanting to know if you've ever fished Silver Creek.
Yes, I did, and I have less hair when I have less hair after I fished Silver Creek than I had before I got there. I fished Silver Creek on the Nature Conservancy water, and it was trico time. And it was amazing how the rainbows moved in pods, and I was trying to target some of the bigger rainbows and bigger browns, and they would take doubles, they would take, I mean, it was the most selective reflecting fishing I've ever had in my lifetime. And this, if I'm going to die and go to heaven, or actually hell, I think God will put me on Silver Creek for the rest of my life.
An exercise in frustration. Yeah.
Oh, my God. But that's what I live for. I live for that. And I could fish Silver Creek every day of my life and be happy as hell because I love frustration. That's why I wrote Selectivity, because frustration, the enigma, the chase, the empirical, the constant tangling of the mind is what makes me going. If I had to, like, if I caught fish every day, I'd quit fishing. Yeah. I know it sounds really weird, but that's why I think we're doing what we're doing as fly guys and fly pattern guys and doing this and that and chasing Atlantic salmon and blah, blah, steelhead. Fish of 1,000 casts, fish of 10,000 casts, because we want the challenge. If it became too easy, we just get a spinning rod and, you know, a cigarette and a can of worms and just go at it. But it's not going to happen.
We got a question in on the internet from Phil. He's down in Kentucky. He says, I like to fish streamers, especially muddlers. Do the fish you most often deal with exhibit selectivity when presented with a well-presented streamer?
Yeah, I mean, you're targeting the aggressive, active, killer artist hunting instinct in that fish. You're targeting a carnivore meat eater, probably most likely a big brown, but there's big rainbows that are carnivores. Can they be selective with you? Absolutely. They'll see the way it moves. They'll see how fast you're stripping it. Are you twitching stripping it? Are you strip jerking it? Are you making pauses? Are you making do you move your fly, your streamer, really quick when the fish is coming, or do you slow it down? These are things that all these kill artists have been seeing. They've seen in the past. They've seen a guy do it too quick, too slow. My advice to him is just to constantly change it up. Don't ever fish one style way of streamer. When you're streamer stripping and tossing meat, never, never be monotone or monotonous in your stripping. Always do jerks, strips, pulls, pauses. Left men's to the right, left men's to the left, just constantly changing it up because fish do not like anything to be too easy. They don't like anything to be too monotonous. They don't like anything to be too humdrum. They want something they can't have. And that kill artist instinct in these big browns goes right to Atlantic salmon. If I had to sum up both of them, Salmo Trutus, Salmo Salar, they want something they can't have. And it's like, you know, chasing that wonderful, you know, girl of your dreams or that girl out there, that guy of your dreams, you know, they're finicky. And you got to figure out how to lure them in.
Yeah,
I don't know how that came up. How did romance come into this? I have no idea.
Yeah. I did an interview with Kelly Gallup, and you mentioned him earlier. And we were talking about streamer fishing. And I can't remember the exact time frame, but I remember him saying that he would probably switch up his streamers every 10 minutes or so and change color, or go to something different if he's not catching fish. He just didn't hesitate at all to change up, and that was a, you know, kind of an overriding method that he used is, I'm not getting anything in 10 minutes, I'm changing up, I'm putting something else on. Because he felt like, you know, on one day they'd hit nothing but white, and the next day it's nothing but black, and you never find out unless you switch up. So that was his
Oh, yeah, I mean, that, absolutely. I mean, switching constantly on streamers, no question about it. The light levels, the way streamers are perceived, the motion of the streamer, UV and polarization, those are the big new buzzwords that are going to be out there forever and ever. You're going to hear more about it, the way that streamer reflects to that fish. And a lot of times guys are fishing constant same water, so we're going to float from here to here, float from here to here, float from here to here. So they saw Kelly's sex dungeon, they saw black, they saw Shank Sculpin, they saw blah, 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 the deadly, you know, drunken disorderly, they saw DD, you know. Yeah, so constantly changing up. But I think as a guide, more importantly, is to go to new water that you haven't pounded day after day. And the biggest problem when you pound water, you know, guiding 250 days a year, these fish become habituated. Habituation is the big key. And they become selective reflective due to the fact that they know, okay, that's, you know, Sapinski's streamer coming out of the bite, or that's Kelly Gallup's streamer coming out of the bite. Same stuff. So, yeah, change, 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 but most importantly, try to get cover new water, arrest water that you haven't fished, because we're creatures of habit. We're sheep with fly rods. We tend to go to places, fish the same way, fish the same time, fish the same place. Fish, they know your gig constantly. So get away from that.
Yeah, it's the Einstein thing of keep doing the same thing and, you know, and expecting different results is the definition of insanity. So applies to fishing
exactly.
As well.
There you
well,
go.
Yeah, yeah.
That's exactly, you know, when I analyzed Atlantic salmon and I used Freudian theory in my phases of selective, passive, dormant, and aggressive, I used Bjørn Johansen from Norway, who wrote the book called The Ecology of Atlantic Salmon and Brown Trout. And I asked him, said, am I off the base for using Freudian id, ego, superego, states of Atlantic salmon? He says, no, you're actually hitting their states. I mean, once again, these are creatures. They're animals. They have to have a life survival strategy. They have to evolve to survive. Humans have to do it. Animals have to do it. Yes, I'm not trying to go against the Bible. I'm a good Catholic boy. I understand the principles. My mother would beat me up right now. But animals and humans really sort of have to go with the life survival strategy, and they're going to do what's going to make them successful.
Yeah.
And it's all about, for fish, it's all about it being a kill artist, being a very efficient kill artist, being a predator, having a predator foraging profile. That's a new word that you're going to see in my new fly fishing article called PFP, Predator Foraging Profile, and understanding that, and then you're going to understand the fish a lot more.
Okay. Got a couple more questions here on trout, and then we'll talk about some steelhead. Bob in Flushing, Michigan, up in your neck of the woods there, he says, when two hatches overlap, say hennies for an hour and then black caddis come on stronger, but hennies continue for a while, do the trout keep on with the hennies, or do they switch to the more numerous caddis? To put it another way, when hatches overlap, is it the first one that stays on the trout's menu, and the second one become more important only when the first is finished? So that's an interesting dilemma.
That's a great answer, Bob. I'm going to tell you something. In my years of experience, you know, I love the Hendrickson hatch. I'm a big caddis freak. You know, I fish with Dick Bopes. I fish with Carl Richards. You know, I still fish with Dick. God bless him. He's doing really well. And actually, I'm going to do a book with Dick. But one thing for certain that you could depend upon is that when caddis overlap a mayfly hatch, there's something very needy about a caddis pupa that turns a trout on more quickly. And I say the same thing about a big ant or a flying ant hatch. There's something about caddis bodies, the silhouette, the more meatiness, or ants. You could be fishing a trichal hatch and all of a sudden you put a flying ant on and bingo, the most selective reflective fish will take that ant, or a midge hatch will take the ant. caddis, there's something about their inability to crack the water, sometimes in the cuticle shock, that makes them very vulnerable in that emerging caddis pupa state, that sometimes they'll ignore the slender bodies of the mayflies. Remember, when mayflies hatch, their bodies are quite slender in comparison, except it's a big hex or a green drake or a brown drake. And they tend to burn up a lot more, so their bodies are more slender. So I think the meatiness quality of caddis, I've had caddis overshadow sulfur hatches, and the fish went right to the caddis. So there's few givens in life. You know, we like steak and lobster. Trout like caddis and ants, okay? And they're going to switch to them at a moment's notice. What else did I have in this question here? Now, when the hatches overlap, is the first one that stays on the trout's menu and the second one becomes more important, only the first, finding the first is finished? This, again, is a really, I talk about a sulfur hatch in my selectivity book that there were tons of dun sulfurs on the water, but the fish were taking burnt up rusty spinners early in the morning. And I think what the fish habituate to is what has been on the water for the longest period of time. And that particular day, sulfur spinners were falling very early in the morning because it was very hot, and they were on the sulfur spinners, the rusty spinners, even though there were a million bajillion sulfur dry adults on the water. So usually first in is the most acceptable, is programmed in the trout's mind, and then what comes along has to have a big impact on that computer programming for the fish to switch to that other insect. I think I answered that one.
Okay. Craig in Portland, Oregon, he says, is there ever a time with difficult trout that you just have to give up and call it a day? For example, it's too sunny and hot, the fish just aren't moving?
Yes, exactly. That happens quite a bit, and you know, there's times where you just have to say, it's not going to happen, and you just have to give up on it because of the sunny conditions, hot conditions, water temperatures rising to 70 degrees, all that stuff, and it's at the top.
Looks like you've got visitors.
No, I got my dog on my deck here. I'm out in the forest. Hold on 1 second. I know you asked me about the dog.
Yeah,
well, we're homie. We're out here in the wilderness.
Yeah.
Thank God for my diesel.
Yeah, everybody, when I brief my guests.
There's a bear stirring in the woods right now. So every time he hears that bear, we have a big female bear that lives right down on the cliff by the Trout and Eagle. And she's had two cubs out here, and so I think you heard it. But I think we're good now.
Okay. Just don't get eaten during the show, okay?
It might happen.
One more question. Let's see. One more question on trout, and then we're moving on. I got one here on the Internet from Larry Hull, Indian River, Michigan. He says, I like to fish at night in the summer for big browns, primarily with mouse patterns. Do you have experience with that? Do you see selectivity in that arena as well?
Yeah, you know, the guys up on the PM, Tommy Lynch, and those guys, you know, the mouse masters, you know, the mouse masters in New Zealand. It's a whole genre and a venue. And what I see in mouse fishing is the fish will either take a very hardly plopped mouse against the wood very tight or something that's very subtly stripped. So it's vibration, and it's individual fish will tune in to individual stimuli or sound or vibration. So some like it gently plopped and stripped slowly. Some like it slammed really hard and stripped as fast as you possibly can. So it's, once again, habituating to certain types of predator foraging profile that the fish will tune in on. So
okay.
That's what's happening.
Let's talk about steelhead, and let's go back to your phased approach here and kind of walk us through how steelhead are maybe different than trout.
Well, you know, these are migratory fish. So migratory fish have one purpose, to come upstream, to spawn, reproduce, and go back to the ocean or go back to the Great Lakes. The difference between Great Lakes and ocean fish is Great Lakes are potamogramous. They have the ability to somewhat ingest food when they come up the system. Whereas ocean fish have to go through the renal system of salinity balance with their food and, I mean, with the system of going from saltwater to freshwater. So the bottom line is you have two different mentalities. So in steelhead, you have freshwater fish that are moved to the river in the aggressive active state. They're bulls in the China shop. They're alpha oriented. They're crashing bait fish in the ocean or the Great Lakes for years, sometimes 3 years for summer steelhead, sometimes a couple of years for Great Lake steelhead. Their aggressive active state when they come into the system with their chrome silver. Everybody wants a chrome steelhead, fresh chrome, dripping sea lice, dripping scales. These fish are bulls in a china shop. They're going to crash a well-swung fly. They're going to crash a piece of tinfoil on a hook. They're going to crash a spinner. They are in that stage for probably the first, I'm going to say 48 hours, okay? And once they get into the river system, they're like, oh, my God, where am I? Here I am in the system now. I better slow my metabolism down. I might not spawn for 6 months. I might spawn in 1 week. I might spawn in 3 months. So I have to acclimate to the river system. So I push myself into the selective reflective mode. So now I am now nothing but a rainbow trout. And basically a steelhead is a rainbow trout. So I must now adjust. I must look at the biological drift. I must adjust my body metabolism, my cost-benefit relationship of caloric input out, caloric input intake. And now I start to acclimate trout. I look at patterns. I look at nymphs. I look at larvae. I once pumped a steelhead on the Muskegon in January, a really big steelhead that was like 14 pounds full of black sludge midge larvae. So what the heck is a steelhead 14 pounds eating size 22 midge larvae all day long? So this is the type of stuff that happens with selective reflective fish. And then in the steelheading PD phase, there's no feeding because they're in the total act of reproduction. Result of extreme angling pressure, unstable weather, unstable barometric pressure changes, and you're going to find out when I talk about barometric pressure changes that a dropping barometer on winter fish is the death knell. And it's one of those days where you just better stay home because it's not going to happen. They like stable barometric pressures either low or high, and they want consistency. So these are the things that steelheading and Atlantic salmon, very close cousins, not by, you know, genetics, but by behavior, it's almost that, you know, id, superego, ego state, where the id is reckless abandonment. The ego is, okay, now I realize that my actions have consequences, so I better smarten up and not smack every damn spawn bag or fly or you know, spinner that comes to the pool if I'm going to make it to Revolution Day, which is when I reproduce. And then the superego is I'm creating my genetic species for the future of my genetic progeny of life survival strategy. So that's how that all comes into play.
We got a question in on the internet here. Mike Clark in Boiseville, New York. He says, what advice do you have for someone who wants to swing for steelhead in New York's Salmon River? I'm told that the fish just don't respond like West Coast fish. Do you think this is true? Maybe the West Coast fish are more liberal? We don't talk about politics on this show, by the way.
There's liberals everywhere, okay? So here's the thing. That's a good question. I fished the Salmon River a lot. Growing up in the Niagara Frontier, we used to fish, you know, the Lake Erie, Lake Ontario tributaries. I know the salmon inside out. I know every pool in the salmon. The salmon is the heaviest fished steelhead river in the world, bar none. There's no other river that gets fished harder. Our Pere Marquette in Michigan and Manistee and Muskegon rivers are pale in comparison. So if you're looking for swinging fish on the Salmon River, you have to catch them in the fresh, aggressive, active state, the AA state. They have to be fresh in the water. They can't be harassed. A lot of them, they are be caught in the Douglaston salmon run where everybody knows they go down to get close to the lake, or you get a high water spate. These fish push up the system all the way up, you know, all the way up to, you know, to the schoolhouse and all the way up to the upper flies water. But they have to be in a fresh migratory state. They have to have somewhat of that 72-hour aggressiveness in their demeanor, and that's when swinging is to be most accomplished. Or you're going to be nymphing them and egging them and doing what you do with selective reflective fish. But they turn off so quickly because of the mass amount of pressure in that system. So aggressive active fish, out of the salt, right out of the ocean, you know, tidal. That's what the Dean River is all about. That's what all those places are about. They're close to the ocean. They're close to the lake. Fish are stupid. Or, in my impression, aggressive active means stupid. That's what you need.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, Bob Brockett in Morris, Illinois, wrote in, and he says, steelhead, in years when we experience relatively skinny water throughout, and it is somewhat easier to locate fish by sight, yet you soon find they are stubbornly selective. How should one start chasing to new fish? Brighter, flashier, or duller, muted, larger overall fly, or smaller? I'm really thinking of a stained river like the Père Marquette that, even in low water, retains some color. I often find that I get it right in the first presentation with a minimum of careful casts. I'm rewarded, but I do get confused which way I should go at the outset in certain conditions.
Okay. So let me see. I'm just starting to understand about skinny water. You're always better off on any steelhead situation going more subtle, muted. One thing you have to remember that the Great Lakes, you're matching the hatch. And I wrote an article on Fly Fisherman last year, or I think last year, last winter. We're still matching. These are rainbow trout, okay? So these guys in the Great Lakes have a total different kill artist, predator foraging profile schematic than a West Coast fish. Brighter and flashier, once again, is good in high water, stained water, aggressive, active fish, yes. More flash, the better, yes. All the big stuff that everybody's throwing on the swing is great stuff. But once again, a rainbow trout DNA is programmed towards ova, round circles of orange and red color. Why? Because 3 million years ago, near the town of San Diego, believe it or not, and the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico, these fish were feeding on salmon eggs because the steelhead always ran on the tails of the salmon run. So it's a natural that you're going to catch these fish on egg patterns. Why guys fish spawn? 90% of steelhead fishermen fish bobbers and spawn out west and here. But always go duller and more natural, and if that doesn't work, if you're in a stained river and you have the luxury of fishing bigger flies and lots of flash, that's great. But he says on the Père Marquette, which I know well because that was my first book, the Père Marquette River Journal, always retains a tannic color. But one of the problems you always have there is that they're attuned to the biological drift of that river, which means hexagenia nymphs, Rhycophilia caddis nymphs, big stone flying nymphs. When you're dealing with two fish, and you know what's interesting is the West Coast people don't think our fish are steelhead because it didn't touch the salt. Well, yes, but they have steelhead genetics. New York stocks, you know, the Chambers Creek, Washington strain, we stock Skamania strain. But their behavior is dictated by their habitat. Their habitat is dictated by the fact that one is pananderous, one is anadromous, one is saltwater, one is freshwater. One is still can ingest food if it wants to. You're always going to, in the Great Lakes, going to tend to go towards the subtler, natural, more naturalistic. But when the conditions are right, swinging flies, it's the way to go, and it's the most exciting way to go.
So what if I'm hearing you correctly, you're saying because the steelhead in the Great Lakes have not gone to salt, they tend to act more like a rainbow than a steelhead in the West Coast might act more like a trout from the sea. Yeah. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. I mean, this is the age old. It's just a 140-year conundrum that we've been chasing. You know, Great Lakes got, you know, West Coast guys say, "Oh, you ain't fishing for steelhead. Those they've never touched the salt. You want to be badass. You got to go to Smithers and blah blah blah." You know. There's a lot to be said for that. And they're fishing, you know, prawn patterns that are 7 inches long. And here we're dealing with minutiae, and we're catching, you know, rainbows, but with steelhead genetics. So you have to understand that they are still steelhead because they come from West Coast genetics, but they have habituated, they've learned in 140 years to have a life survival strategy and a predator foraging profile that dictates what they're going to do on a daily basis, on a yearly basis, on a weekly basis. So this is the cool thing about selectivity, applying it to these, you know, migratory fish. But then again, these migratory fish act as extremely selective, like rainbows. Like the other day, we caught a 14-pound chrome dripping on my blog steelhead that was gurgitating size 14 stonefly nymphs out of its mouth when I took my size 12 stonefly nymph out of its mouth. So The beauty of steelheading is that it's technical. It's trout fishing.
Yeah.
So you always have to remember trout and steelhead. Steelhead equals trout. Trout equals steelhead. They're rainbow trout.
Yeah.
If you remember rainbow trout, and you know, look at the beautiful experimentation with Bonnie Waller swinging on the Dean River. You know, swinging. Why are these fish taking these swung dry flies on the surface? Because these massive caddis hatches and these massive stonefly hatches out there, these little paw, these little juveniles,
yeah,
at a young age, natal imprinting to these food forms. This is what makes it happen. This is how they do it.
Yeah. Okay, we're running out of time, so we still have to hit salmon here. So I want to jump down to salmon, and let's talk about the three phases for salmon and how they differ from steelhead and trout.
They're very similar. They're, you know, the beauty of Atlantic salmon, you know, most Atlantic salmon guys and most of the steelhead guides, they sort of go hand in hand because they understand the fish. But in the Atlantic salmon, the AA phase, fresh run, spring, fall, you know, rising spate conditions, this off-color is going to bring the fresh fish in the system. They migratory into the bays early in May and June, like up in Gas Bay and Labrador and Russia. The most aggressive salmon will be taking up tailouts at the pools, at the head of pools with those smaller males. But the AA phase of Atlantic salmon is very similar to steelhead. They are out of the ocean. Kill artists, they were eating capelin, they were eating squid, they were eating crustacea. When they come into the system, they're dripping sea lice, they're silver as a bell. They're attack, they're total attack mode. And I call it Freud's id stage, which, you know, I'm just reckless abandonment. I'm chewing on everything. I'm like a little baby chewing on whatever. I don't give a crap about anything. And then they get into selective. Once the fish have settled into the holding pools, realize they better slow down because they have 4 months, 5 months to go before they spawn in October or November. Then they start focusing on smaller flies. They look at biological drift. They look at water temperature. They look at the biology. So Atlantic salmon and steelhead, almost absolutely identical. Selective reflective phases. And that's, once again, what I said about Freud's ego stitch. And then, Pastor Dorman, this is prevalent in pooled up Atlantics. Atlantics have a great tendency to be pooled up, stay in those pools, especially if you go to the Gas Bay, you know, Labrador, Miramichi, it's hot, summer. They're conserving themselves for the last final assault, which is procreation and making sure that they get their genetic, you know, lasting output to the next generations.
So are they similarly to the steelhead, are the freshwater Atlantic salmon acting in the same way as, you know, when you just did the comparison between the West Coast, the salt, the fresh?
Well, Roger, that's an excellent question. Yeah. Our landlocked Atlantic salmon that we have here in the Great Lakes and Torch Lake and stuff like that, they're very similar to steelhead. I mean, they have a tendency to come in quickly. They could still chase bait fish. They still want to ingest bait fish. They really can't do it because of their body. Their stomachs shrink because they need to make some room for their roe and their sperm development. But they have a greater tendency to negate that renal system salinity balance that happens with anadromous fish versus podomadromous fish, which is freshwater to freshwater. So they act the same way. So, I mean, literally, Atlantic salmon and steelhead. The only thing I could say about steelhead is that they're a little more aggressive active. They're more, I could say, dumber, stupid, whatever, because people like dumb, stupid fish, and that's why steelhead are so popular, because they'll take the same damn predator over and over again. I caught the same steelhead twice in the same day. Well, you're not going to see that with Atlantic salmon, because Atlantic salmon are trutas. They're salmo. Salmo truta is brown trout. Salmo salar is Atlantic salmon. They're very similar in their mentality. They're very elusive. They're photophobic. They're wary. You're never going to get a dumb Atlantic, or you're never going to get a dumb brown trout. That's a given. And the guys at Fish Forum know exactly what I'm talking about.
Interesting. Okay, we have a couple questions on salmon. Tom Collison in Flagstaff, Arizona says, fall sight fishing pools for spawning kings on rivers like the Pere Marquette can be difficult. Are the salmon being selective, or just in the spawning mode? Any recommended approaches for triggering a strike?
Yeah, Pacific salmon, they have a very, very short term of any phase, to be honest with you. They go to the passive dormant so quickly that it's amazing because they have the least amount of time spent in the river system. So our Pacific kings here, our wild kings of the Muskegon, the Paramarquette, everywhere, they smolt at like 3 to 4 inches. So they have very little natal imprinting to food forms in the river system, where Atlantic salmon and steelhead usually smolt after 2 years. So they're rainbow trout or baby brown trout. I call baby salmon baby brown trout because they basically have the same mindset. So your best bet for sight fishing pooled up fish on the Paramarquette, make sure you get there in the first 72 hours that these fish come in the system, because they'll still exhibit aggressive active phases. They will tend to strike big, you know, they these thunder sticks, they do these Rapalas with orange and chartreuse, and they'll get fish to take those. But I find that a black and chartreuse and black and orange egg-sucking leech long intruders with, you know, trailing intruder hooks stripped through the pool early morning will get some aggressive active strikes on these fish. Other than that, they go really quickly to the spawning mode.
Okay, okay. One final question here on the Internet. Hans in Valdivia, Chile, he says, your book made it all the way to Chile.
Oh, that's nice.
He says, in your book, Selectivity, you talk a lot about trout, steelhead, and Atlantic salmon. What is your opinion of selectivity for Chinook salmon? Does Chinook tend to be more in the aggressive state than the other states? What's your opinion on Chinook flies to respond to their states?
Yeah, exactly. Again, you know, if I had to write a chapter on Pacific salmon, it would probably be like two paragraphs. That's why I didn't do much of Pacific salmon, because they are in an aggressive, active state for the first 48 to 72 hours, and then it's completely passive dormant. They go straight to spawning, and they have a very high order of this super eagle that they're going to go right to get the job done, make, you know, make babies, and get the heck out of there and die. I mean, they have a very short life. Their mission, their life survival strategy of Pacific salmon is to come in really quickly. You know, I'll still have the aggressive ocean predator kill artist bait fish hunting in me, but it's going to be gone within 48 hours because I have to make babies, I have to get reproduction going, and then I'm going to die. That's where Atlantic salmon do not die. Steelhead do not die. Lake Run brown trout, Tierra del Fuego brown trout in Argentina do not die. So that's the difference, that they have a job to be done, has to be clear. But then you have some extremely aggressive, active natures in coho salmon, which are silver salmon. So, you know, it's really interesting. But they are very quick to be aggressive, active, and then shut off the passive dormant, then die.
Okay, one final question here. David Cordy in Los Angeles, he wants to know, what was one of the most interesting, unusual, weird, or memorable experience you've had while fishing?
Oh, God, jeez. That I can't answer that one. There's a story of the – let him just read the book. In my book, there's a story of the orange ant on the Delaware. And it just totally – just tell them to go to my book, get my book, read that. It's a long story. I don't think you have time for me to tell it. But from a selectivity standpoint, it's about the most selective, reflective, biggest, beautifulest, most snooty, wild rainbow trout, wild genetics that came in late 1800s to the Delaware. And I threw every fly for 6 hours to this fish, and he took a little size orange 20 ant that he just loved and made no sense. So the absurdity and the total absurdity, if you're an existentialist, which I am to a certain degree, the absurdity of fly fishing is the fact that when you think you have everything figured out, you think you've known everything about everything, something absurd that makes no sense whatsoever seals the deal and closes and cracks the code. That's the beauty of fly fishing.
Yeah, good closing comment. All right, Matt, we've run out of time. So, but stick with me here, because we're going to be giving away a copy of your book to the closest listener here tonight. And we're also going to give away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. So stick with me. Matt, I want you to make sure you stick around so that we get the right answer to the question I'm going to ask. So,
Sounds good.
Okay. A mining company called Pacrim Coal is planning a massive strip mine near Anchorage, Alaska. The Chewitna Coal Project would be the first project in Alaska history to mine directly through salmon habitat, the Chewitna River drainage, 11 miles of it. Critical commercial, sport, and subsistence fishing economies would be permanently destroyed. Pacrim says it can rebuild a salmon string, but scientific experts can find no example where successful restoration has occurred after strip mining. Chewitna coal would be shipped to Asia, leaving Alaska with nothing but devastated habitat and ruined salmon runs. It's time to stop the Chewitna coal strip mine. For more information about how you can help, visit www.inletkeeper.org. That's inletkeeper.org. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave our website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, what did you think of the show? Just click on that link, leave us your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Now it's time to give away a few prizes. Winners for our drawings are randomly selected from our show's registration database. And if you didn't register for tonight's show yet, it's too late now, but do so for the next show because we're always giving away these prizes, and it's great to win. So we have for our winner for the one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, we have Larry Widens, Larry Widens in Colorado. So Colorado Fly Fisherman. Thanks, Larry, for joining us in the drawing here, and congratulations. We'll get a message out to you by email to let you know about how we're going to fulfill that prize. So Larry wins a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. And if you want to learn more about the Federation, if you don't know about them or you're not a member, go to fedflyfishers.org. Fedflyfishers.org, they're a great organization, support a lot of restoration projects and so forth with both freshwater and saltwater, so check them out. Second thing we're going to give away is the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, one-year subscription to that, courtesy of Amato Books. And our winner for that is Phil Panko. Phil's a longtime listener, and Phil, thanks for joining us again. Phil visited me at one point out here in Colorado, and we did a little fishing. So congratulations, Phil, on winning that Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. Okay, now let's give away Matt's book, Selectivity, courtesy of Stackpole and Headwater Books. And this is a really, you know, stellar book, everyone. So only one of you is going to get a copy tonight. But I would definitely check this out with Stackpole or Amazon and get yourself a copy. It's one of those must-have books for your library. So let me clear my queue here, make sure nobody's in there already. And now you just have to go to the homepage on our website, askaboutflyfishing.com. There's a text box there that you can fill in, put your answer in. And the question will be, and I don't want the initials, but give me two of the phases that Matt has that we've been talking about. I don't care which ones, but there's two of the phases, and each phase has two parts to it. So I'm looking for two of those phases. Give me that, and you. Okay. Okay, and we've got, Matt, here's the first answer, aggressive, active, and then selective, reflective. Well, he got it there, and he gave me all three, passive, dormant. So I think he got it, didn't he?
He got it, bingo.
That's a deal. Ted Hasselbring in Nashville. Ted, congratulations. You're going to be really pleasantly surprised when you get this book. So congrats. You were the first one, and you got all three. So you were paying attention. So now Matt will fill in the gaps for you once you start reading his book, won't you, Matt?
Awesome. That's great. You got great country down in Tennessee. You got some great tailwaters, a host in the clinch, some incredible selective, reflective fish down there when those sulfur hatches go. So hope you enjoy it and enjoy your tailwaters.
Yeah, yeah, great, great. Well,
I talk a lot about those Tennessee tailwaters in my book, so you'll enjoy it.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, that'll be a bonus for him. Yeah, good. Well, that's all we've got for tonight. I want to thank you, Matt, for being on the show and spending time with us and dodging the bears up there in North Country. So I never thought of being on my show as somewhat dangerous, but maybe so. I don't know. Or maybe you pet that bear, you know, while you're drinking your scotch.
It's one female black bear, and she's shyer than hell, but she comes around at night, so.
Well, we're good to go. Our next show, hold on with me for just a second here. Let's see here. Our next show will be on the 20th of May, and it's going to be at 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And it's going to be with Mike Kephart. And the show's going to be on Colorado's lost lakes and secret places. And Mike's going to give you the scoop on which Colorado mountain and wilderness lakes and creeks fish well and how to get there, the difficulty of access, and what you can expect to catch. So join us as we explore these lost lakes and secret places. We'd also like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers for sponsoring tonight's show, as well as Amato Books, Stackpole Books, Front Range Anglers, and Women's Fly Fishing in Alaska. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing on Net Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.